This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Jonathan Mooney, a graduate of Brown University with an honors degree in English literature and a recipient of the Distinguished Truman Scholarship for Graduate Studies in the fields of creative writing and disability studies. Jonathan also is co-author of the book Learning Outside the Lines and is president of Eye to Eye, a nonprofit mentoring and advocacy organization for students with learning disabilities. Jonathan Mooney is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal, published in 2007 by Henry Holt and Company. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
What led you to write your book, The Short Bus?
Well, first, I think it's important to understand that The Short Bus is a memoir. And The Short Bus is also a really tangible, physical symbol of disability in our culture. For your listeners who aren't familiar with that symbol, the short bus literally is a vehicle that takes students with disabilities to segregated special education programs, not all around the country, but in many places in the country. I grew up in special education. I grew up as one of those kids, you know, one of those kids who was chilling with the janitor in the hallway, you know, one of those kids who was on a first name basis with Shirley, the receptionist in the principal's office, you know. I didn't learn to read until I was 12 years old. I dropped out of school for a year in sixth grade. I was told that I would flip burgers. Yet, as you mentioned in my introduction, that didn't happen. Graduated from Brown. And The Short Bus, as a memoir, really explores that journey. It explores that journey from somebody who felt like they had no place in our society, literally. I mean, I had a plan for suicide at 12 years old, to somebody who now feels engaged, connected to his education, connected to his community. So that transformation and exploring that transformation was really the catalyst to the book.
In the book, you talk about a trip that you took to visit a variety of individuals. What prompted you to take the trip on the short bus?
Yeah, the book itself, while a memoir, as you alluded to, is a memoir told through the sort of narrative strategy of a 35,000-mile, four-month journey around the United States in a converted short school bus. I bought a school bus. I converted it into an RV. And I drove around the United States wanting to visit people who had different labels. I don't really like to call or to say people with disabilities, because many of the people in the book don't think of themselves in any way as disabled. They think of themselves as cognitive or physical minorities who were marginalized in our culture because they didn't fit the norm. So the catalyst of the journey itself was really a desire to explore not disability per se, but really the power of normalcy in our culture. You know, the subtitle of the book is a journey beyond normal, and that's really the goal. Normal is a devastating idea. You know, it is. There's a great quote from Michel Foucault, a philosopher that really has inspired me in my journey. To paraphrase the quote, he says, you know, we are in the society of normalcy, and the judges of normality are everywhere. We're in the society of the teacher judge, the doctor judge, the social worker judge. And each and every one of us, our bodies, minds, and gestures are subject to the tyranny of normalcy. And I wanted to explore that. I wanted to see how normalcy worked in our institutions and in our public policies. But most importantly, and this is really the heart of the book, I wanted to see how people resisted normalcy, how they transformed it, and how they lived authentic, individual, singular lives, not despite their differences, but because of their differences.
Could you say more about how we react to people who are cognitively different?
Well, I think the reaction in our culture to cognitive difference is one of hostility. I mean, I think that's the baseline, and one of marginalization. I mean, let me ground that in two ways. Let me ground it first in the most basic, small way in my life, and then in a little bit broader public policy issue. You know, I was told, because I didn't have the mind like everyone else, I was told that I was stupid, crazy, and lazy. I mean, at a young age, literally. I remember turning to my mom in second grade and saying, "Mom, why am I stupid?" And the reality is that I was far from stupid. I don't even believe that there is an objective, quantifiable form of intelligence. I believe in multiple intelligences. I believe in the work of Howard Gardner. But nonetheless, stupid, crazy, lazy, put in a segregated special ed program, grew up in the hallway, grew up with the message that my mind was broken. So that's a reaction of hostility. So that's an individual reaction. Let me translate from the small picture to the big picture for a moment. Most people don't realize that in America in the 1920s, you could be forcibly sterilized by the state if you were deemed defective during the American eugenics program. Most people don't realize that 40,000 Americans were sterilized because they were deemed defective, cognitive physical minorities whose bodies were forcibly modified by the state. That's a silent history we don't talk about. It's a history of aggression, it's a history of hostility, but it's also a history that actually inspired Nazi scientists. When the Nazi scientists embarked on their eugenics programs, they came to the United States to model their practices after our practices. So I think that the overarching history is one of hostility, it's one of marginalization, and it's one of forced conformity. Conform to the norm, or you are at risk and you have no place in our culture.
To what extent have the concepts of normal and disabled changed over time in the United States?
Great question. I think that there's been historically on a big trajectory, a positive forward movement, to be honest with you. Now, I think that that positive forward movement is intrinsically related to the actions of people with disabilities, to the disability rights movement, which is a fairly new civil rights movement, if you think about it. The pieces of federal legislation that protect the rights of individuals with disabilities, the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, was passed in 1992, you know? So in our scope of civil rights, it's kind of late in the game. But I'm inspired by the disability rights movement. I'm intellectually influenced by the disability rights movement. I'm a proud member of it because what I think the disability rights movement is doing is it's doing two things. And this is really where the disability in our culture is changing. It's first defining disability as not a medical issue. It's a really radical concept. It's defining it as a social issue. Let me say that differently. I'm dyslexic. You give me a piece of paper right now, I read it, the words are all over the page. But dyslexia wasn't what disabled me. What disabled me was dysteachia. You know, what disabled me was this myth that there's one type of mind. People in the disability rights movement are making the argument that somebody in a wheelchair is not intrinsically disabled. They become disabled by the fact that there's not enough ramps, by the fact that there's stairs, by the fact that we haven't built universally accessible buildings. It's a radical statement to make. The other statement that the disability rights movement is making that really changes our culture is that this is a civil rights issue. I mean, at its core, not a medical issue, not an issue of more diagnosis, treatment, assessment, fixing of disabilities, but one of how do we protect people's rights? How do we make sure that hate crime legislation covers people with disabilities? People don't realize the violence that people with disabilities are subject to in our culture on the street. It's one of the most highly abused minority groups in our country physically, and it's not covered under hate crime legislation, which is fascinating to me. So again, the long-term trajectory is one of improvement, but it's coming because people with disabilities are fighting for their civil rights.
Let's talk now about your trip on the bus. How did your own perception of normal change during your trip?
It changed radically. I mean, if you ground the short bus in my personal story, you have to understand that I had a very conflicted relationship with normalcy, as many people with invisible disabilities do. You know, you look at me from on the outside and you think, oh, you know, John is normal. That's what you think, you know? So there was a real tendency, and this was specifically when I went to Brown, to pass as normal. And I really used that language of passing, to borrow a term from the African-American community, from the gay, lesbian, transgender community, passing. I tried to pass as normal for a long time, really setting up into my mind a real cognitive dissonance, where on one hand, I'm trying to be normal. On the other hand, I know that I have differences that should be celebrated and embraced, especially when it comes to my way I think about the world. So I began the journey as somebody sort of split in two like that, literally wanting to be on the other side, but hoping that I could feel comfortable in who I am. And journeying through normal, experiencing people who had radical physical differences. I mean, there's a chapter in the book called How to Curse in Sign Language, which is a story of my time with a young woman named Ashley, who's deafblind, and her mom, Deborah. And I'm very honest in that chapter. In the beginning of that chapter, I did not have empathy for Ashley. I had sympathy for her, which is totally different. I didn't see our common humanity. I didn't see what we have in common, because all I could see was that her eyes didn't work, her hearing didn't work, that she made so-called strange noises. And the journey of that chapter is how I learned to see what Ashley and I have in common. And that was a radical transformation for me, to reject that passing and to celebrate and find sort of kinship and brotherhood with people with these radical physical and cognitive differences. And that's really the heart of that journey.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Jonathan Mooney, author of the book, The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. Drawing from examples in your book, what are some ways people who have been labeled as learning disabled have contributed to our social fabric?
I think the best example from The Short Bus is the profile and the story of a gentleman named Kent Roberts. Kent Roberts is a performance artist, an author of a book called The Portrait of Yo Mama as a Young Man, which is a book of Yo Mama jokes by two white guys. Highly conceptual book with Yo Mama jokes such as, your mama is so lupine, she chases rabbits. And lupine means wolf-like. I had to look it up. And Kent Roberts is the embodiment of how creativity, in some respects, comes hand in hand with some significant neurological deficits. Kent Roberts has the attention span of a gnat. Literally, he'll tell you that. He doesn't make eye contact. Kent Roberts has a difficult time being in relationships. Kent Roberts has a hard time managing money. There's a real question of whether Kent Roberts can live successfully in the world. Yet his creativity goes hand in hand with those weaknesses. For example, Kent did 24 hours of stand-up comedy at Brown. 24 hours straight. Didn't stop. That's not attention deficit disorder. You know what I mean? In that moment, that was a gift. So Kent Roberts is really an embodiment of the paradox of creativity. That as we move forward in our culture, we have to understand that paradox. There's a temptation in our culture now to norm and sanitize all of our minds and quite frankly, our genes, you know? There's a worry in our future that if we can do a genetic test for ADHD, which we may be able to do in the future, that people like Kent Roberts won't exist. And what we'll lose is we'll lose creativity. We'll lose unique thinking. We'll lose that cognitive diversity, which is the essence of a healthy human fabric and community.
Could you say more about the other people that you met on your journey? For example, what did you learn from Katie, the young woman with Down syndrome?
Katie and her mom, to give your listeners some backstory, they live in a small farm in a small town in Seaman, Ohio. Katie is a young woman with Down syndrome. And the challenge of that chapter, which is called Katie's Book of Life, is really a lesson in that ecosystem of humanity and the importance of it. And that's not my metaphor. It's actually Katie's mom, Candy's metaphor. At one point in the story and my time with them, she says to me that we, all of us, are connected in a fabric and an ecosystem like a rainforest. And if we change one variable in that, the whole ecosystem is drastically modified. She's making the argument that somebody can be of value. They can have worth as a human being, and their life can be of value simply by being present, which was a radical statement for me, because at that time in the narrative, I'm really struggling with this idea that the only way I'm of value as a human being, me, Jonathan Mooney, is if I produce, consume, and succeed. You know, a really dominant American consumer value system, right? And here I'm in this farm listening to Candy say that her daughter is of value simply because she's present, because she's a part of this fabric of our common humanity. And again, a really radical argument. Down syndrome, I alluded to the concerns around ADHD, but Down syndrome is really the number one front in the battle of what I consider to be an emerging eugenic philosophy. Genetic organizations and the medical community will say without equivocation that their goal is to find a way to eliminate Down syndrome from our genome, from our human population. With the rise of prenatal testing, 90% of women who are given a diagnosis of Down syndrome choose abortion. Katie is an endangered species, again, her word. And that really was a lesson in what we'll lose as a culture if we go down this path of norming ourselves to such an extent that there's no place for Katie in our society.
When we label children disabled, what are the ramifications for the children? You've said a bit about this already, but
The ramifications are first and foremost, I think, a real, and I know that it's sort of, it's popular in our culture to talk about self-esteem, as it should be in some ways, though it's overused, but a real devastating destruction of a child's sense of self. And I go above and beyond self-esteem, a calling into question of that young person's core self. The label of disabled at a young age is "you're broken." I mean, really, that's what it was for me. John, you are broken. You're the bad kid. Your mind doesn't work. You need to stop being who you are, or you have no place. You can get out of the classroom. You can be banished to the segregated special ed room. You can be banished to the short bus. That's a really devastating message. And again, I take a lot of intellectual and emotional inspiration from the work that's been done in the African-American community about the devastating impact on the African-American, the black sense of self by segregation, by the messages they were received, because I think there's a synergy there. It's "you're broken." And the challenge for parents, if there's parents listening, and the challenge for individuals, and the challenge for institutions, is to fight that message. You're okay as you are. That's the message we have to find a way to give. If we run schools, if we have young people like me, if we care for cognitive and physical diversity in our culture.
You've alluded to this also, but when we label children disabled, what are the ramifications for society?
Well, first and foremost, it sets in place a particular domino of public policy. And this is really important. You know, I really believe in the importance of language and in the importance of ideas, specifically to impact public policy. When you conceptualize a young person as disabled, as intrinsically broken, you've made an intellectual assumption that informs all of your actions and all of your public policy. It leads to a system that is almost entirely grounded in deficits of what's wrong with people. It leads to a system that has no consciousness, no ability to identify the strengths, gifts, and talents of individuals with differences. It leads to a system that's imbalanced from a power perspective, leads to a system in which I'm the passive patient who needs to be treated by the expert. And I really believe, to kind of come out of the niche of the disability rights community and talk about what's universal with this, I believe that the civil rights and the experience of people with disabilities is really a battleground for all of our society against an expert culture and against a culture of pathology that wants to find a sickness for every human difference. And guess what? Wants to sell you something to treat that difference. There's a real, I think, consumer mentality in the culture of pathology that's at the center of disability experience. You're broken, buy this to fix you. And that goes all the way down the line to, you don't pay attention well enough, here's medication to fix you. You experience sadness, here's something to fix you. And that's a real universal struggle.
What characteristics seem to make children labeled learning disabled able to survive or pull through?
Three characteristics really come through the profiles in the book and really the research that I've done. Because this book also is really grounded in research around the social history of cognitive difference, research around best practices for young people who have these experiences. So the three variables that I see run through every single story is, number one, they've had a strong advocate at a young age. And that advocate, 90% of the time, has been mom. You know, that was me. My mom was a fighter. My mom was 5 feet tall and had a high-pitched voice like Mickey Mouse, you know, and she cursed like a truck driver, you know. And my mom was in that office every single day when things weren't going well for me, and she was fighting for me. And every person in this book who survives this experience has that. Second, the people in this book and in our culture broadly, they've redefined the LD story. They've redefined it from one of I'm broken, I need to fix myself, to one of I'm different and I've been marginalized. And that redefinition allows them to acknowledge wrongdoings in their past that's been done to them. And it allows them to take their anger, and opposed to being self-destructive with that anger, which I did in the past, have it be transformative. Last but not least, people in this book who are successful, the last variable is they've developed a passion for something. They developed an asset-based identity. They have a purpose. If somebody is pursuing education, they're doing it because they have a sense of purpose in their education. They've developed that sense of something they care about. Passion's an amazing thing. It really is, you know. Kent Roberts is somebody, as I said, can't sit still for 5 minutes, but he's passionate about stand-up comedy, and he does it for 24 hours.
How would the world or society be different if we transformed our ideas about what is normal?
I think first, we would have a radical reshaping of many of our institutions. I mean, that's really the first thing. We would have a sort of seismic shift in the way that we conceptualize education and learning. And frankly, I'm hopeful, or to use a phrase, I'm cautiously optimistic that that shift in education can occur. If you look right now, we're in a moment of real opportunity for educational change. All the brain research and neuroscience is going down the path of different cognitive structures, different ways to think about the world. But where's our public policy going in public education? The other way. Standardized education. That's a cultural cognitive dissonance that cannot survive. It can't. And it will break apart. There's a moment of creative destruction that I think is in our future around education. So if we value people with cognitive differences, we remake, we redefine how we learn, what we learn, when we learn. And that's a radical thing. Second, I think we redefine how we work. It's a powerful thing. One of the core tenets of the disability rights movement is that individuals with cognitive differences should be given accommodations in the workforce. And I think that that's appropriate for cognitive diversity broadly defined. Can we build working environments that allow me to access information in a way that's unique to me and right for me, to put out information in that way? That'll make people happier, healthier, more productive. Lastly, I really do think, and this is really inspired by Candy and Katie in the book, I think that if we embrace these experiences, we develop a new value system. We develop a value system that in many respects is synergistic with the value system of the environmental movement, with the sustainability movement. We develop a value system that's not about the consuming American. It's not about what we can produce, consume, and strive for, but it's about the engaged, interdependent American. That's the essence of the disability rights movement. It's the essence of what Katie was challenging me to see. We're not individuals. We're interdependent. And that's a powerful idea.
What advice do you give to students who have been labeled as learning disabled?
You're not disabled. It's a cognitive difference. If you look at the brain scans, dyslexics often have a higher visual IQ. They have higher verbal capacity. There are neurological strengths, gifts, and talents that come directly from this experience, not despite this experience. You've been treated poorly in school, almost uniformly. You need to name that. A lot of young people go through schooling with that conflict that, well, maybe really I was stupid. Maybe really I am the bad person. They believe that about themselves. You have to unearth that. You have to understand that the fact that you grew up in the slow reading group, you know, does not mean that you were stupid. It was wrong for you to be put there in the first place. That was me, you know. Everybody knew that my group was the stupid group. My group was a bird that did not fly. My group was an ostrich that ran quickly. Everybody knew that, and that was wrong. And that's really the first step towards change, is to name that marginalization. To say it was wrong, to talk honestly about it, to talk openly about it, and then begin that path of finding out what's right with your mind and bringing that into your education.
What advice do you give to parents of children who have been labeled learning disabled?
Fight for your kid, first of all. I mean, first and foremost, be an advocate. You know, the research is unequivocal that individuals with learning differences, learning disabilities who are successful in their adult life, the common variable is that they're self-advocates. Literally, I mean, that trumps IQ, that trumps academic success, they're self-advocates. Young people learn to be self-advocates watching their parents be advocates for them, you know? Now, being an advocate is a complex task. It requires a lot of different tools. The most common tool parents use is anger to advocate for their kids. My mom had some anger management issues. You know what I mean? She was there. She was cursing up a storm. Every dog in the neighborhood was running away because of her high-pitched voice. Anger is one tool, but it's not the only tool. So I really encourage parents as they advocate for their children to develop that multifaceted skill set to be an advocate, which really is fundamentally grounded in partnership. When you can build partnership with an educational institution, then you're on the path to modeling effective self-advocacy skills for your kid.
To what extent is the American viewpoint on disability the same or different from other countries?
The American viewpoint is, in many respects, behind much of Europe. I mean, again, we have to ask ourselves, what countries are we talking about? Mm-hmm. But if you look at Western Europe, the American viewpoint is fairly behind. And the reasons for that are multifaceted, but the broad social trends are, first and foremost, Western Europe has a much more developed sense of social responsibility to people. the sort of social democracy mentality, and people have better access to healthcare. They have better access to services. Mm-hmm. They have better access and more control over their environments, mm-hmm. their working environments. Now, the one caveat I would add to that, however, is in education. In some respects, while Western Europe has a more progressive attitude in public policy, it's regressive in the respects to education, because it is one of those, most of Europe is embodied in a British educational model, which is one of testing, in ninth grade that determines all of your academic future. Jonathan Mooney would have been tracked in a European educational model to be a shop worker at a young age. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's an honorable profession. If that was right for me, great. But the American institution of education has flexibility and elasticity. I have the capacity to change my educational course here. I transferred to Brown, went to my first university on a full soccer scholarship. I was the stupid, dumb jock, had a renaissance, transferred to an Ivy League university. You can't do that at Oxford. You can't do that in England. But on the whole, the Western European attitudes, because of that commitment to social welfare, it's a much more progressive and inclusive place for people with disabilities.
Would you briefly tell us about your Eye to Eye project?
Project Eye to Eye is a nonprofit organization based in New York City. I'm the founder and president of that organization. But it's really something that I started while an undergraduate at Brown, which was almost 10 years ago. It's a very sort of almost deceivingly simple programming model. What we look to do is we look to bring older adults, young adults with labels, learning disabilities, into the lives of younger kids with those similar experiences as mentors, not as tutors, but as role models for a positive future. We build chapters, chapter-based organizations, so we partner with institutions of higher education to find the young adults with disabilities to work with younger kids. We train those individuals who do that work. We provide them with funding, provide them with models. We provide them with curriculum. Right now, we have 20 chapters in 16 states. I can say that we don't have a chapter in the great state of Washington. And if anyone is interested in developing a chapter, it costs the school being mentored nothing. We cover all those costs. If anyone's interested in becoming involved with Project Eye to Eye, they can feel free to contact me at jonathanmooney.com. It's a wonderful program that's really changing lives. You know, we've had a partnership with Harvard's Graduate School of Education to do an outcome-based assessment for the past 2 years. This year, it's being done by Columbia Teachers College. And without question, every single young person, and I broadly define the person doing the mentoring, the person being mentored, transformative results in that core sense of self that we were talking about before, that sense that they're not broken, that's challenged, and that's transformed, and that changes lives.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Normalcy is a social construct. It's a fiction. It doesn't exist. It has a history to it, which most people don't realize. The word normalcy did not enter the English language until the 1850s. That was a radical shift in human consciousness. Before the normal, there was the ideal. The ideal was something you could never obtain. It didn't exist in the world by definition. But when we replaced the ideal with the norm, it was a tyrannical imperative of be normal. If you fix this about yourself, you'll be normal. If you do this, you can be normal. And it's a fiction. Normalcy is an illusion. It leads to an empty life, an empty culture, an empty society. And the challenge is for each and every one of us to define ourselves, to use a term from Diane Arbus, the photographer, to define ourselves as singular individuals.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Jonathan.
Honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
We have just been speaking with Jonathan Mooney, author of the book The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal, published in 2007 by Henry Holt and Company. For more information, check on the web at www.jonathanmooney.com. Again, that's jonathanmooney.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.